Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
I'm Nicholas Timmins. I'm the public policy editor of the Financial Times. And with me today is a three-generation medical family. There is Dame Margaret Turner Warwick, who qualified as a doctor in 1950, and thus was a medical student on the wards in July 1948 when the National Health Service came into existence. She went on to become the first woman president of the Royal College of Physicians, indeed the first female president of any of the medical royal colleges. Alongside her is her daughter, Lynn Turner Stokes, who qualified in 1979, and is now Professor of Rehabilitation Medicine at King's College London. The third is Tabitha Turner-Stokes, Lynn's daughter and Margaret's granddaughter, who just this week completed her final examinations at University College Hospitals London to become a doctor. And we're here to talk about, obviously, 60 years of the National Health Service. And the obvious place to start is its history and its launch, Margaret. I mean, you must remember it coming into existence.
Yes. There were, in fact, great divides in the medical profession. The BMA, which was particularly the general practitioners, was very sceptical, and particularly they were afraid of the erosion of their medical independence. Mm. The consultants were rather different. They were divided. Some of them were afraid that it would inhibit their private practice and their money, but a lot of the ex-service people coming back at that time were desperate for jobs. They'd been used to discipline in the armed forces, and they were very much in favour of it. And, of course, many doctors during the war had worked with the Medical Emergency Service. Lastly, many of the consultants worked for no pay at all at voluntary hospitals. Their entire earnings were in private practice. If they were to be offered some remuneration for the work they were doing in the hospital service, they were not altogether against it.
Very attractive. And when you look back at medicine then and medicine now, what you could do as a doctor in 48, 50,
yeah.
I mean, that must have been when the first antibiotics were arriving.
Of course, the medical advances have been absolutely huge and immense. And perhaps the most dramatic example is actually tuberculosis, with this immense service that was built up to deal with all these chronic and continually ill patients, when in 1952, suddenly, there was a cure.
Can you recall, in a sense, what was the most advanced thing you could do when you qualified?
Well, that's really interesting. One of the most dramatic things was just the very, very beginning of open-heart surgery. And in order to get them cold enough, because cardiac bypass hadn't been invented then, they used to put them in a bath full of ice and cool them down that way.
Gosh. Almost sounds like leashes, doesn't it? Right. Now, how do you think the profession and its relations with the health service have changed over the years?
To begin with, the role of the doctor was dominant, and they were assisted by a very small team of administrators. Then, I suppose, in the 60s, 70s was the time that management began to become more important and strengthened.
Right. And then we went through this sort of period of consensus management, which turned out to be the lowest common denominator or no decision at all, because everybody had a veto. But for a lot of doctors, they kind of opted out of being involved, opted out of medical management, and then complained about the results and said it's all the manager's fault. Lynn, is that a story that sort of...
Yes and no. I mean, I think that all the way through there have been doctors who've been involved with management, as you say, honourable exceptions. But there was a clear move to say that doctors were too powerful in determining what should happen and having the ultimate high moral ground of saying, I'm going to do this for my patient because this is what I believe is best for them, regardless of cost. There's always been this tension that if you're going to try and deliver a health service that's free at the point of delivery for everybody, regardless of means, based on a really small percentage of the GDP, then you've really got a a challenge in terms of being able to provide that and keep it within costs. And I think that that's been a challenge for a lot of doctors who, you know, perhaps better aware of the limitations of the evidence than some of the managers who will just stick on what there's grade AE recommendations for and leave it at that.
Yeah. And sort of running through this is a sort of tension, not just in the National Health Service. These days it comes with being in any medical organisation anywhere in the world. Tabitha, you're about to qualify. How does that, how does that look to you compared to how it may have looked to Margaret when she qualified?
What I can see certainly happens in an everyday setting on the wards is that there is this constant conflict. I can't see how that conflict would ever disappear. I mean, there's always the added conflict of government policy that constantly changes, and there's constantly new targets. Something that I nodded when my grandmother was saying that, you know, that's something that didn't have in the past.
Yeah.
The poor manager is twixt a rock and a hard place because he's got to manage the doctors on the one hand and work with them, and he's got to watch his back with the politicians and government on the other. In fact, I think I've seen in recent years doctors and managers really ganging up and getting together a bit to try and have a stronger say in some of the pressures imposed by the politicians.
The other bit of continuity is sort of societal changes that affect medicine. So, I mean, when you were a house officer, how much time off did you get?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. We didn't get any time off. When I was houseman, I had one night off in 6 months.
You were on duty every weekend?
I was on all the time, 24 hours a day, for 6 months, bar one night. Right. One of my favourite patients died on the night that, we had most particularly challenging one on the night I was off, so it's written indelibly on me. But the point really was that wasn't as stress-making and as outrageous as the EU would have you believe, because we had a very small number of patients. The continuity of care, you knew those patients so well, you knew what was going to happen to each one at the night or the day.
Yeah.
So the whole setup of support was vastly better, I believe, actually, one way and another. Although sometimes a bit unorthodox than it is now. And I believe that a lot of the problems of the long hours is the stress and anxiety of young doctors working a little bit beyond their competence because there's nobody else around.
Tabitha, can you imagine having one night off in 6 months?
I absolutely couldn't imagine getting one night off in 6 months because that night, you know, all the other nights other than that night would be horrendous. Whereas I think in the past... Yes, I'm sure you were very tired and sleep deprived, but it wasn't the horrendous experience I've certainly when I've shadowed. I mean, I'll have this pleasure when I start working in August, but I've shadowed a lot of people at night, and it's absolutely, I'm not exaggerating, it is really horrendous, and there's just so few of you, and you just don't know the patients, and it's unsafe.
It's absolutely dangerous,
and everyone thinks it's dangerous. This is the problem. I think one of the things that certainly I've seen a lot of patients complain about and a lot of the fuel for a lot of the newspaper disaster stories that come out are patients' experience in hospitals, not just as inpatients, but patients' experience with the administrative end of hospitals, like outpatient appointments, getting to and from hospitals, transport issues, and so on. And I think a lot of the fuel that comes out is patients saying, you know, oh, there was needles on the floor and there was, you know, it was really dirty, my cabinet was really dirty, the cleaners never came by. And I think that a lot of it stems, I'm sure a lot of that's true. And again, it goes down to inadequate funding, I think. But a lot of it, I think, comes from patients' general experience and attitudes towards hospital. They just don't feel cared for.
Cleanliness is a really interesting one, particularly with everybody now being aware of MRSA. I was saying the other night, one of the first reasons when I knew I wanted to be a doctor when I was about 3 years old was because I knew when I was taken to hospital for, you know, to meet up with mum or dad in the evening if we were doing something, or was always that lovely smell of disinfectant as you walked in. It was just wonderful. I knew that's where I wanted to be. And you know, recently, you know, you haven't smelt that smell when you go into hospitals. And I was just walking into my hospital the other day, and all of a sudden, you get this lovely smell of disinfectant because they suddenly discovered it again now with RSA, and it's exactly the same smell as it used to be. And it's like coming home, really.
Yeah.
But you know, for years we didn't use disinfectant. I think it was decided that it was wrong.
And women in medicine.
I'll just ask
the question. I mean, how's that changed?
Well, how has it changed? It was relatively easy to get into Oxford in 1943, but getting onto the women's quota, which was 7%, was a tricky business.
Yeah.
So that really says it all at that time.
Was this the women's quota to get into Oxford at all, or to do medicine?
To do medicine. To a large extent, I think, you can ignore gender. And the more you do, the better, so I don't think it should be a thing. But again, history, you asked for. In the 1960s, if you wanted to get on to, as a woman, onto a teaching hospital, was very difficult.
Mm. But that's for you to ignore gender, which is not the same as the other.
No, but if you ignore gender,
right,
then they'll ignore gender. If you start putting on the tears and all that business, that's where you get into trouble. What do you think?
I was very fortunate in having lots of family support, and spent all my taxed salary for years on a nanny, a live-in nanny, who would just be there, so I didn't have to worry about inconveniences like babies. I went back to work when both of them were 3 months old, yeah, because that was the only thing I think to do, and I've always worked full time. And I think because of doing that, I haven't come across any kind of adverse effect of being a woman. But I think had I gone part-time or, you know, wanted special concessions, then I would have been treated differently. Yeah. And I have to say, quite right. and I think I'm a bit tough on my women colleagues, actually. I think it's one of the things we have to sort of bite the bullet about, and there's a choice, I think, that we have. And you know, one can either choose to be a womany woman and do womany things, or you can be a non-womany woman and expect to be able to be accorded the same privileges as non-women.
Right, Natalie. Now you know, 7% when Margaret's doing it. Now we're in a majority.
Yes,
and what about the womany woman?
I think there are actually some advantages, tiny little things, advantages of being a woman, actually. As a student, particularly in this day and age with chaperones and things like that, I think you get a lot more opportunities, actually, as a lot of the men that I've worked with find it a lot harder just getting clinical experience. But I think that's a student thing rather than a professional thing, because obviously when you're qualified and you're professional, it's your job. The womany woman thing and the manly woman thing, I mean, I totally agree. I think I think I'm absolutely for women having equal rights, and I think, you know, obviously men and women in a profession that's as big and as broad as medicine, I think there's a big place for both.
Yeah.
But I think women can only say that and have the equal opportunities if you can also put in the equal amount of time. And unfortunately, just because of the fact that we can have kids and men can't, that is, there's nothing you can do to change that. So, I mean, I agree, I have the same attitude.
Yeah.
I would very much like to have a family and children. I also remain very committed to my career in medicine, and I would hopefully be able to mix those two as effectively as my grandmother and my mum have done, because I think they've both done it extremely effectively, but I'm sure it's very hard.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.